I could please reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, ma'am.
May it please the court, on behalf of LaShawn Miles, with respect to the sufficiency argument, my argument is that there's not sufficient evidence to convict Miles of obstruction of justice where the Commonwealth failed to prove that she knowingly impeded Detective Travers' investigation. This court held in Atkins in 2009, 54 VA App 340, citing the Ruckman case, 28 VA App 428 from 1998, that to sustain a conviction under Virginia Code 18.2460 subsection A, there must be acts clearly indicating an intention on the part of the accused to prevent an officer from performing his duties. To obstruct means to obstruct the officer himself, not merely to oppose or to impede the process the officer is tasked with. Further, obstruction of justice does not occur when a person fails to cooperate fully with an officer or when the person's conduct merely renders the officer's task more difficult or frustrates the officer's investigation.
All right. Stop me if I'm wrong, but I mean, you don't have to make the officer's job easier. But the evidence here shows the defendant locked the car doors and tried to roll up the window to prevent Detective Travers from reaching in. Why is that not an affirmative act that's beyond just passivity or failure to make life easier for the officer?
Well, I would take issue with the court's characterization of her locking the door. I don't think there's any evidence to support that she locked the door after the officer started his investigation of that vehicle. I think the evidence was merely that she was in the vehicle and that by the time that he approached the car that the doors were locked, not that she intentionally locked them or locked them to try and keep him out. With respect to rolling up the window, it's our argument that it was Miles's action of rolling down the window, which ultimately allowed Detective Travers to seize the car, because when she rolled down the window is when he reached in and unlocked the door.
This case comes down to whether or not this is a case of lack of cooperation, as Judge McCullough has sort of identified as one component, or obstructing justice. When you're looking at the facts and circumstances, you actually have to give deference to the trial court. So the fact finder's determination as to what was what. Trial court could have theoretically come up with the idea that she was just being uncooperative and it wasn't an obstruction of justice, or conversely could have come to the conclusion that it was indeed an obstruction of justice based on the facts and circumstances existing. Wouldn't we have to substitute our judgment for that of the trial court if we were to say, oh, she was just not cooperating as opposed to obstructing justice?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And I think that primarily the trial court's findings mischaracterized her behavior as active as opposed to passive. The trial judge characterized refusing to get out of the car as an active act as opposed to a passive act, and that's the distinction that the law makes.
If that had just been the only thing, we probably wouldn't have this case, but we have more.
Yes, we have additional conduct, but again, there's no evidence that she locked the door to keep him out.
I'm looking at pages 13 and 47 of the appendix. He sticks his arm into the vehicle to unlock it. As he was trying to unlock the vehicle, she rolled the window up on my arm. And similar on page 47.
Yes.
Explain to me again why that's not actively thwarting the officer whose arm is in the car. She's rolling up the window on his arm.
I think because it's an unfair inference that her goal in rolling up the window is to prevent him from unlocking it or to do anything other than express her dissatisfaction.
That to me is a perfectly sensible inference where the officer is reaching in to unlock the car. She's rolling up the window to block his arm. Now, maybe there's some other explanation for it, but it strikes me as a fairly obvious fact finding that that was done to thwart the officer who's reaching in.
Well, what's missing from the evidence, I think, is any suggestion that she knew that he was going to unlock the door when she rolled down the window.
Why does that matter?
I think she could roll down the window to talk to him, to listen to what he was saying.
But she's rolling it up. That's what I'm getting at.
Oh, yeah, certainly. When she rolled the window up, I don't think it's entirely clear that she was doing it to stop him from unlocking the door. Merely, and I think the most significant factor was that she did not relock the door. She could have relocked the door when he unlocks the door. She does not do that. she rolls the window up and sort of, I would suggest, an expression of her dissatisfaction for the proceedings. And it was her testimony, which I understand this court may ultimately disregard, that she was, that the reason that she did not get out of the car is because she was upset about how she was being treated by the police, and that she didn't understand why Detective Travers had told her when he seized her first vehicle that she was free to go, and then proceeds to seize her only alternate means of transportation.
But don't we always have to look at facts in context? And I could envision a situation where, suppose Detective Travers was in an unmarked car, he wasn't readily identifiable as a police officer, it's late at night or early in the morning, and she's a woman by herself, and there's a man coming up that she cannot identify as a police officer, and he tries to reach in as she's locking the door and gets his arm rolled up in the window. To me, that's an entirely different set of circumstances. But here, it seems to me that you have the predicate for, she knows he's a police officer, There's an encounter that's going on, and she is doing what she can to at least undermine the encounter.
And what I would submit to this court is that is, under the law of obstruction, passive resistance. She's dissatisfied that he's attempting to seize the vehicle, and she's not going to help him do it.
So actively rolling up the window is passive?
No, it's an active act. I certainly don't dispute that was an active act, but that it was not done with the intention to stop him from seizing the vehicle, only to express her dissatisfaction, as best indicated by the fact that she does not relock the door. With respect to the closing argument, assignment of error, it's our argument that the trial court erred by not permitting defense counsel to make a closing argument at trial. Under the Fish case, 208 V.H. 761, 1968, the Supreme Court of Virginia held that closing argument is an integral part of the criminal proceeding, and accused is entitled to be heard in argument made by her counsel. The right to closing argument would be utterly destroyed if the court were allowed to prohibit argument merely because the evidence is so clear in its opinion, in the court's opinion, that argument cannot vary it. The right of argument, if not waived, is entitled
clearly,
to protection.
Closing argument is often the point of high drama in the trial where you marshal all the evidence presented, etc. This is a bench trial, right?
Certainly.
Does it matter that there's no proffer of what that argument?
I don't think that it matters that there's no proffer under the holding of the Fish case, because the defendant has the right to closing argument whether or not it will sway the court's mind.
Right, but by statute, we're directed, even if the Commonwealth doesn't argue harmless error, we're not supposed to reverse something unless it was harmless. And so, and as we all know, there's some closing arguments that are spectacularly good and some that are not so good or even counterproductive. So without a proffer, just like with evidence, I mean, unless we know what the evidence is, it's hard for us to figure out what impact that might have had.
And I would suggest that the prejudice is her right to closing argument being violated, not that the content of the closing argument would have swayed the court to
And there's a few categories of error that are structural, that are not, like you want a jury trial and the court says, no, I'm not giving you one. We don't assess the prejudice of that. So there's, one example. But there are very few such structural errors. Usually they're subject to harmless error analysis. Why is this some kind of structural error as opposed to...
Well, without the proffer, Your Honor, I think I am arguing for a per se prejudicial finding in that it is a part of the trial, it is the right of the defendant, and she was not granted her right to closing argument.
Were you trial counsel?
No.
Okay, I'm going to read you the exchange regarding this issue, and you tell me where the suggestion that of counsel was present. Appellant's counsel, we don't get argument. The court, that was argument. Appellant's counsel, oh, I thought it was just a motion to strike. Is that final argument as well? The court, no, I've heard all I need to hear. And besides, you had two opportunities to argue on that motion. I find you guilty as charged. How do you want to proceed? And I was a trial lawyer, and I know that when a judge tells me something, I tend to sort of shut up so as not to go to jail myself. But at that point, isn't it the obligation of counsel to say, Judge, with all due respect, I appreciate the court's ruling, but statutorily I'm entitled to closing argument and I would like to make it on behalf of my client or at least proffer for the record what I would have said. And if the judge says, no, you can't say anything more, then you shut it down. And I believe any court, any panel of this court would say, you did all you could do to make your position known to the court. Why do you think that in the context of this, this is enough, unless you're saying that there's a per se rule that you're entitled to it, notwithstanding whether you make the argument for it or not?
I do think that it is enough what is contained in that request. Well, as the court suggested, trial counsel could have argued would be perhaps a better, clearer way to argue. What is contained in the exchange between defense counsel and the court is a request for closing argument and a clarification that he had not yet made closing argument, merely had made his motion to strike, renewed motion to strike, and responded to the Commonwealth's argument. And I think it is clear in the trial court's response that the trial court understood defense counsel had intended to make...
But we're stuck with the context of words. And the context of the last thing that appellate counsel said is, oh, I thought that was just the motion to strike, is that final argument as well. If counsel had said, oh, I thought it was just a motion to strike, I'd like to make my final argument, and then the court said, no, I've heard all I need to hear, we're talking about a different kind of case, I think.
Perhaps, Your Honor. I think, though, that it is clear from the court's response that he understood the defense counsel had intended to make closing argument, still wished to make closing argument, and the court was basically telling defense counsel, I don't want to hear it.
You're in your rebuttal time.
Yes, sir.
You want to save the rest of that.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Gene Murphy for the Commonwealth. On the first point, obstruction, I think it's clear, as you pointed out already, there is obvious active obstruction by the defendant. The fact that she's rolling up the window when the officer's obviously trying to get into the car to unlock it, to get her out of the car, she's clearly at that point acting in a way to obstruct his efforts to get into the car, to inventory it, to search it. I think it's clear at that point that there is obstruction. The car was locked when the officer returned. Don't forget that the girlfriend had already gotten out of the vehicle to go back and talk to the officer in the cruiser. So the car was unlocked at that point when the officer leaves. Sometime in the interim, the defendant relocks it. And then when he efforts to get her out of the car are unsuccessful, the officer tries to get in. She tries to prevent that. It seems to be clear that there's obstruction here. And the obvious intent of what she did was to prevent him from getting into the car. So I think there's not the slightest question about the obstruction. On the closing argument, I think the court's already pointed out, there are lots of ways the defense counsel could have made it clear to the court that, well, Judge, I know that you think that's enough, but I want to go ahead and argue. That
And the cases actually draw a distinction between, I mean, if you don't say formally, I've got a motion to strike, then you may waive that issue.
Yeah, sure.
If you're relying on closing arguments. So there is a distinction between the two, but I think you have to point that out.
Right, because don't forget, along the same line, a lot of times they are combined. There will be just one argument on motion, combining both legal and factual credibility issues, and that will put the court in the position sometimes of having to decide what's the sufficiency issue preserved. Because there's not unusual in a bench trial for there to be that combination. And because of the court's discretion in this area, it seems to me that you have to make it clear to the court that, wait a minute, I've got some credibility claims I'd like to put before you. I've already got my legal issues out there.
Your opponent colleague suggests to this court that the failure to grant closing argument or to allow closing argument should be a per se rule, which essentially undermines the faithfulness in the trial disposition. What would be your response to that?
Well, that's just not true, Your Honor. I mean, it can certainly be waived. You can waive closing argument. It's not anything that's essential to the process. Here the question is, what did he get? The real question with closing argument, did he get before the court everything he wanted to say? And if in fact, when the court says that, you've already done what you wanted to do in closing, you're not entitled to present the same argument over again. If the judge, if you tell the judge,
You would agree that in this colloquy that went back and forth, oh, I thought it was just a motion to strike, I would like to make my closing argument. If the court said what it did say here, no, I've heard all I need to hear, we'd have a different case.
Somewhat different, Your Honor, but I think there'd still be a question of, the question is, does the attorney accept the judge's determination here? Says, well, all right, Judge, I understand what he's doing, and yeah, we've probably argued enough. If he says, Judge, no, I definitely want to argue some more, I want to get some more things out, that'd be a real, there wouldn't be any waiver. And then we might get to the merits and say, well, has the judge really denied him the right to present evidence?
I mean, he still may have a problem with the proffer.
Yeah, sure. I mean, and I appreciate your bringing that issue up. One of the problems with no objection is that we have no idea what defense counsel wanted to argue. I mean, if he says, well, I wanted to repeat my discussion of the legal concepts here. Don't forget, in this case, in the statement of facts, the defendant says the facts are mostly undisputed. You know, there's not a lot of factual discussion here. That we're not, the issues of credibility don't really come in into this case. You know, we all agree what she did. She says, I did it because it was unfair. I was being treated unfairly. Well, the real question in this case is, was what she did an obstruction of justice? Not, did she really do these things?
As I understand it, there's really no factual dispute with regard to the underlying facts of the case.
Yes,
the question is, from a determination as to what the facts are, does this or does it not rise to the level of obstruction of justice?
Exactly, which is a legal issue, Your Honor, it seems to me, and that was fully treated in the two motions to strike. So even if the objection were preserved somehow, I think the judge still did not abuse his discretion in saying, well, I've heard everything I hear, have to hear here, and that there's nothing pointed out that would have been made a difference if, in fact, if a closing argument was made that would address primarily factual disputes and credibility. So I would suggest for those reasons that the decision below should be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ma'am, you have about 3.5 more minutes if you want to use it.
Just to briefly respond to a couple of points that the Commonwealth made.
Yes, ma'am.
With respect to sufficiency, the Commonwealth's position is that the obvious intent of Ms. Miles was to prevent Detective Travers from getting in the car, and I would suggest the fact that she didn't lock the car again disputes that. With respect to the closing argument, although yes, as a matter of law or as a matter of practice, closing arguments can be waived, or defense counsel can choose to combine closing argument and the motion to strike, but they're different things with different standards. And in this case, closing argument was not waived. But
as Mr. Murphy points out, the problem is that from this record, we cannot discern what that closing argument would have been.
Yes, that certainly is true. And while the facts are not disputed in this case, what is disputed and is still disputed on appeal is the application of obstruction law to the facts of this case, which could be the content of closing argument, although not necessarily the same as motion to strike.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Matter